This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
Ryan, we got a special guest here today. Who have we got?
Yes, we have a return guest today, one of my all-time favorite guests. He was on with us on episode 43, again on episode 67. I think he might have been on another time there as well at some point. His name is Matt Abrahams. Matt is the author of Speaking Up Without Freaking Out. He's a lecturer at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and the co-founder of Bold Echo LLC. Matt has written an article in the August 2016 issue of the Toastmaster called Be Confident When Called On. Matt Abrahams, welcome back to the Toastmasters podcast.
Welcome, Matt.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here with you guys. I always enjoy chatting with Toastmasters about all these topics.
Here we are, Matt, as we're approaching the end of summer and back to school season is right around the corner for us. Appropriately, you open your article talking about cold calling your students, that is, calling on your students, putting them on the spot to answer a question or give some feedback, as you're a professor here of strategic communication. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that and how students react to that experience when you begin the semester?
Sure thing. And just for the record, I do not cold call on my students because I know the amount of stress that it puts on them. But many of my colleagues do, and my students, and students, I believe, universally fear that moment of when the finger points at them and the question comes in. And the challenge for the student is they want to give the best answer possible. And because of that desire to respond in that moment to that question that they may or may not know the answer to, it puts so much pressure on them, they actually get in their own way. And in many cases, they're not even able to answer any question, let alone the question that's asked of them. And this question plagues students of all ages, of all levels of knowledge. It's a really challenging and demanding situation.
So is this performance anxiety that we're talking about essentially?
So it is a form of performance anxiety. They want to do it right for sure, but there's also a whole slew of other factors that get in the way in terms of thinking about the relationship to the content, relationship to the professor, relationship to the fellow students. Their head is just jumbled with concern. As I developed the process that I talk about in the article, I did lots of interviewing with my students and with executives and professionals and Toastmasters, trying to understand what do all of these spontaneous speaking situations have in common. And clearly, performance anxiety is a big part of it.
So you open your article with your first tip out of the three here is the one you just mentioned, get out of your own way. Of course, we've been talking primarily in the context of a classroom, but this applies to the workplace, to social situations, anytime when you're sort of put on the spot to deliver a message, to communicate. I know you're encouraging people to speak with confidence when they are called to speak, but how do you do that when you're not certain of the answer or certain that the answer you have to offer is necessarily the best solution? So let's say your boss calls on you and says, you know, there's a situation in the office here. There's a discord among the staff, let's say. And maybe you haven't really thought of it that deeply. So you're kind of just giving your gut reaction to it, but you don't know if you're really coming up with the right answer. So how can you appear confident while not necessarily being certain or even saying, geez, I don't know, it could be this, it could be that. What are your thoughts on that, Matt?
So there's a lot going on in there. And first, I would be very impressed if I had a boss that said there's discord in the office. But what happens for many of us in those situations, in that situation we're being asked to give our feedback or our assessment of a situation in a spontaneous way, many of us get so locked up in our head about trying to assess the situation immediately. What do I need to say? How do I say it? Do I offend somebody? Do I throw somebody under the bus? All of this is going on in our head, and it freezes us from being able to respond at all. So my point is, rather than fall victim to all of the cacophony in our head, we really just need to focus on, I've been asked to give my opinion. Here is my opinion. Get out of my own way of all of this tumult going on in my brain. By doing that, by putting aside all of the evaluation, all of the judgment, all of the perspective thinking, I free myself up to actually give a more coherent, in some cases a more honest answer that will not only serve the obligation of responding to the feedback or the request for feedback, but it then allows me to come off as more comfortable and confident and ultimately perhaps give even more insight. So we have to train ourselves. This is like any sport. If you watch athletes play a sport, they have drilled and practiced so many times that when something happens in that moment, it's spontaneous, they know how to respond. The way you get there is you just practice giving feedback a lot, and you practice giving it without evaluating and doing all of that mental gymnastics, so that when your boss does say we have discord in the office, you can give your opinion and feedback, and ultimately it will come off as more confident. When you start getting caught up in your head and evaluating and judging, that's where you come off as being less confident.
So you're referring to this, the pre-speaking, the things that, that negative self-talk that kind of clouds your mind even before you have an opportunity to formulate an answer.
Yeah, it's the negative self-talk and all of the evaluative stuff that we go through that's not just about ourselves, but it's about assessing the situation. If I say this about Sally, then what does that mean about Sally? And what does that mean for Fred? And we do all this mental calculus so quickly that it gets in the way. And what neuroscience tells us is it limits the ability to focus our attention and really, therefore, be able to communicate effectively.
I wonder, Matt, if there's also something to be said for giving yourself permission to take a provisional stab at the question.
Certainly. So allowing yourself permission feeds very nicely into the second bit of advice that I give in the article, which is to reframe the speaking situation as one that's not full of threat and challenge, but of one that is of opportunity. It is an offer to you to do something that further educates, enlightens, connects what you're saying to someone else. So in essence, you're giving yourself permission to see this speech act, the spontaneous speech act, as one that is positive, not negative and threatening. So there is this notion of agency and there is this notion of permission that really does factor into this.
So how do you convince yourself of something like this?
Well, it takes a risk. It takes yourself being willing to take that initial risk and say, hey, I can try this. I can see this as something positive. So part of it is just having that willingness to take the initial risk. The other part is retrospective. I often encourage my students or the clients that I coach to reflect back on a time where things went really well in a spontaneous speaking situation, and we diagnose what happened. And often people realize that they did just jump right in, that they did allow themselves to see this as something positive. And by remembering the success they had when they were in that place, that helps encourage them to do it moving forward. So it's the willingness to take risk and the willingness to recognize when in the past we've been successful with that. And it can really help.
So it sounds like this can really get rid of that adversarial, us versus them type scenario and more along the lines of, I've done this once before, I know I can do it, therefore let's just go ahead and try it again.
Correct. And part of it is also realizing that the people with whom you are speaking are often there in support of you, trying to learn from you, hoping for your success. So really the communication is much more collaborative than challenging. And allowing yourself to recognize that does a whole bunch of things for you beyond making you a more comfortable, spontaneous speaker. It helps you feel more confident. It helps you tailor the message to them. It helps it be more interactive. So this mindset has a whole slew of benefits beyond helping you speak more spontaneously.
I think there might be another aspect to your tip two, see it as an opportunity not an obstacle, and it being that moment when you're called upon to share some information or perspective spontaneously. And what I mean by that is it's not just an opportunity to clarify or explain or share your viewpoint, but it's also an opportunity to practice speaking off the cuff. And I was thinking about this and reflecting on your article, and I think of those times during Table Topics when I'm called up to speak on a topic that really I don't know anything about. I think it would help my mindset to begin my response with, thank you for the opportunity to practice. I think that would help me to relax and recognize what it is that I'm doing by getting up to Table Topics. And it also takes some pressure off because I'm signaling to the audience that, hey, this after all is just practice. And I think we could maybe not say that out loud verbally in every situation, but at least say to ourselves when we get, quote, put on the spot, to just say, oh, look, it's an opportunity to practice.
I love that suggestion. And as Greg mentioned earlier, you know, we say a lot of negative things to ourselves. How did I get myself in this situation? Oh, my goodness, I'm going to make a fool out of myself, or I should have prepared better. What if we could replace that with, wow, this is a great opportunity, or I'm excited to share or practice. So if we, even if we just say that to ourselves, it puts us in a position where we are at least not putting ourselves in a one down position when we're coming to communication. So I like that as a technique for sure.
I should have used that opportunity when I was asked about opera. It's like, no, please don't ask me that question because I don't know anything about opera.
Oprah, I could talk about.
Not opera.
There's a story there that I at some point I need to hear.
Go ahead.
No.
So Matt, your third tip in the article has to do with leveraging structure, which sounds very technical and complex. What do you mean by leveraging structure?
So whenever you have any speaking situation, but particularly spontaneous speaking situation, you have two things to manage. You have to manage what you're saying and how you're saying it. And cognitive resources have to be dedicated to both of those. If you can train yourself and prepare yourself to have structures for how you will say what you say, you can actually loosen or reduce your speaking load. So, for example, one of my favorite structures and one I discuss in the article is the what, so what, now what structure. I love this structure because it is so useful. I call it the Swiss Army knife of structures. You can use this to do many things. So, for example, the way in which I have been answering the questions that you guys ask me is in this structure because questions, by their very nature, are spontaneous, or at least my answers to them are. I answer the question, that's the what. The so what is I explain why it's important, and then the now what, I explain what people can do with it. So because I have that structure in mind, I can just think about what do I put in the structure. Similarly, if Greg said, oh, Matt, you know, I know you're going to be in my neck of the woods, and I'd like to bring you to the Toastmasters group I'm part of, and I'd love for you to introduce who you are and what you do. That introduction could be a what, so what, now what. What is it I do? So what is why is it important? And now what is how it will apply to other people. So using structures helps you free up your cognitive bandwidth so you can focus on what you're going to say within that structure. The added benefit to the audience of the structure is that it makes it easier for them to understand because we love information that's structured, and neuroscience tells us that we process it better when information's in a structure and we remember it longer. And it also sets our audience's expectations so they're more comfortable and they can receive our message better. So I am a big, big supporter of having structure when you speak.
It also seems like it's easier for you to deliver your answer because you're breaking it up into smaller little components.
Exactly. So if you have something that's rather lengthy, breaking it up into those components of structure can help as well. And I'll tell you, when I coach executives, they love structure, not because of all the things I've just shared. They get that, but they say structure tells them when to stop talking. They feel like they talk beyond what they need to say. And if you follow the what, so what, now what structure, for example, after you've said now what, you're done speaking. So it gives you a way to know when to stop talking.
That's a great point as well. And I think the effectiveness, whether you're using the what, so what, now what, or the problem, solution, benefit, which is another one that you talk about in your article, and I'm sure there are many others, but I think one of the keys to success with it is having that structure down cold, so to speak, so that you're not on top of having to think of what to say and how to say it. You're not also trying to say to yourself, and what's that structure again? It starts with what, but what's the next one? You know, so right. If you have it sort of like pegs in your mind that you can just sort of hang the different components on. And to that point, I have a suggestion that I'm going to try out in my Toastmasters Club, which is as Table Topics Master to present the what, so what, now what structure and invite people to come up and give a Table Topics response to my question specifically using that structure. And then as each speaker finishes as Table Topics Master, I will ask the audience, okay, what was the what? What was the so what? What was the now what? So it'll be reinforcing it to those who are both practicing it and hearing other people practice it.
I really like that idea, and it really reinforces that people focus on structure and not just when they're speaking, but be able to look at and look for those structures. I'll tell you very quickly how I got better at doing this. Whenever I would read anything, an email, a magazine article, whatever, when I was done with that article, I would summarize it in whatever structure I was practicing. So if I was practicing the what, so what, now what structure, I'd say, what was the article about? Why is the article important? And what can I do with that information now? Similarly, when I look at an email, what's the email about? Why is this important and what can I do about it? And you just begin training yourself to see that and quickly be able to put information into that structure, and it helps tremendously.
The what, so what, now what, you need to make sure that you don't use a sarcastic tone.
That's correct.
I'm just thinking about a former colleague I used to work with when I used to develop computer systems. He would say, what? Ah, so what? Now what?
Delete.
But it's great. I'm thinking here, someone the other day was asking me about this movie I saw, and there's so many things about the movie. It's like, well, tell me about the story. What's the movie about? You could summarize what the movie was about by using this what, so what, now what technique.
Sure thing.
It's brilliant. Now, in terms of table topics at the club level, I notice quite often that if someone gets a question they don't know or they don't like, they turn around and they change the question. Now, of course, in competition, that's not a good thing. And in reality, when someone asks you a question is, do you know the way to San Jose? No, but I can tell you how to get to Toledo. Obviously, that's not going to fly. What are some thoughts or techniques or tips that people can use at the club level that can help them, obviously, in the real world?
Well, with any situation where you are put on the spot to respond to something that is not, either you don't know the answer to or you're not comfortable answering it, if there's a way you can reframe it to be something that's more comfortable for you to respond, then that's the way to do it. And I am certainly not saying become a politician and answer the question you wish you were asked rather than the question you were asked. But I coach people all the time, and I teach my students this reframing technique, is find a way of taking a kernel of what somebody's asking you and address that before you get back to their issues. So for example, this happens to salespeople all the time. Somebody might challenge them on price. They might say, why are you so expensive? Why does your product cost so much? And rather than diving into price right away, they could say, so what you're really asking about is the value our product provides. They could then talk about the value proposition, something they're very comfortable talking about, and at the end say, and because of the value that we provide, we believe our price point is right. So if you are asking me, how do I get to San Jose, which, by the way, I know how to do since I live just 20 minutes from there, I might say, you know, traveling in general is something that we really have to think about, and we have lots of tools and technologies that can help us. So if I needed to get to San Jose, I would first invoke my GPS, and then I could give a whole table topic on GPS and all of that. So I'm finding a connection, a link that's relevant, that's appropriate, but I'm talking about that, and that can help me feel more comfortable.
I just had music on the brain. That's all. I was still thinking about the opera question.
Well, Dionne Warwick and an opera singer are a little different.
That's true. I still remember a table topic question. I believe it was at the area level, and it's, what's your favorite color and why? And it's amazing how sometimes the simplest question can be the most difficult to answer. And of course, for those of you who know Monty Python and the Holy Grail, getting the wrong answer, you can end up in a deep gorge.
That's right. But I would argue that the simple questions like what's your favorite color, why they're so difficult is, again, that mental gymnastics we go through rather than going with our initial response, because the sky is blue or I used to love blue crayons, which is our initial response. We begin evaluating and saying, I can't say the sky is blue. People are going to think I'm silly, or, you know, crayons, I'm a professional. I shouldn't be right. So all of that mental gymnastics gets in the way of us just having a very natural start from which we then build confidence and ultimately give a really nice response, but we get in our own way. So sometimes the simplest questions are the ones that trip us up the most because we evaluate so frequently. If you'll allow me, I'll give you a classic example of this. When I teach this to my MBA students at Stanford, I leverage a lot of improvisation games because it's a fun way to learn these concepts and it's very low stakes. And one of the very first games we play is we play this game called Shout the Wrong Name, where you stand up and point at things, and the only rule is the things you point at, you have to shout out some name other than what they are. So if I'm looking at a chair and pointing at it, I call it a cat, not a chair. You would be amazed at how some of the world's best and brightest students freeze because their mind will not let them call that thing anything but a chair. And once they get themselves to unlock from there, they stockpile 20 different things that they're going to call the first 20 things they say. So they already have in mind what I'm going to say before I say it because they want to get it right. So the simplest of games, the easiest, all you have to do is say anything but what it is, becomes super challenging because they don't want to get it wrong. That to me is fascinating. But once we get through that activity, you see these epiphanies and all of a sudden people let go, free up, and we have just amazing spontaneous conversations.
It sounds like, was it Alvin Toffler that said one of the most difficult things to do is unlearn something?
Absolutely. And I totally agree.
You've given us some incredible tips and techniques in terms of improving our prompt to speaking, but out of curiosity, obviously you're teaching MBA students. What's your experience with them, some of them coming in and perhaps they're fearful of not answering the question, but even fearful of being called on? What's your experience with that and how do you handle that at the level that you're at?
So there are some people who are just afraid of being asked to speak. So it doesn't have to do with spontaneous or not. And as Ryan knows, I've spent a lot of my life really trying to help people develop comfort and confidence in speaking and just being present, showing up. And the book I wrote, Speaking Up Without Freaking Out, talks a lot about the techniques for doing that. So with students who have that degree of concern about speaking, we work on lots of different techniques. So in some ways, we spend time rationalizing. We say, what's the worst thing that could happen? And if that were to happen, what's the worst thing that can happen from that? And how likely? So we do some rationalization. We have people list out their concerns and their cognitive appraisal of those concerns. So that's that negative self-talk. And ultimately, for all my students and all the people I coach in my consulting practice, we create what I call an anxiety management plan. We come up with very specific techniques that are unique to each person and have them create 5 to 7 techniques that they can use to help them feel better and more confident when they speak. Just showing up and using those techniques can help these students feel much better. And when my students leave my class after a quarter, they feel much more comfortable being part of the conversation, being called upon, and actually taking the floor. And it's a very rewarding experience for them and ultimately for me as well.
So you're customizing the way that they can overcome that fear. That's interesting.
Absolutely. And that to me is the only way to do it. You can't pass big, broad swaths of advice and expect everybody to fall suit. The book I wrote has 50 techniques, and I expect only 10% of those to actually apply to any one person. And it's about finding the right technique to work for you. And that's trial and error, but ultimately you can do it.
Yeah, before we got on with you, Matt, I was sharing with Greg, and you'll remember this, Matt, mm-hmm. that several years ago I was asked to be the test speaker for the evaluation contest at our district. and I was given less than a week to prepare my speech. And right after I agreed, the district governor said, "And oh, by the way, please make it funny because it's going to be followed by the humorous speech contest."
Ryan, that's hard for you, right?
Well, I'll tell you, Matt's book, Speaking Up Without Freaking Out, became my, I think the Latin term is Vade Mecum, which is sort of the book that you carry with you everywhere you go. For that week, I just devoured the book. And Matt, I shared with you my, I think I probably used 30 of the 50 techniques, my management plan. I cannot even begin to say how helpful that was for me. And I ended up giving a speech that I was very, very pleased with. More importantly, I was able to control the pretty significant anxiety that I had about pulling something together very quickly and getting up and delivering it in front of the largest group that I'd ever spoken in front of to that point in my life. Thank you again for that, Matt.
You're quite welcome. And I love hearing stories like that. It really validates not just the work I do, but the importance of people confronting this fear and finding ways to do it. Because, you know, this sounds kind of hokey and corny, but I truly believe everybody has some important stories to share. And so many people are fearful of speaking and communicating that we as a collective miss out on those perspectives and those stories. So I love when I hear examples like you just gave of being able to get up and do that, because that means we now have some information, some knowledge we didn't have before because you felt comfortable enough to share it. So that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And Matt, I love the story in your article as you talk about what happens at the end of the semester with your students. So as we close out here, could you share what's different at the end of the semester and sort of the ritual that you do with your students?
Because of certain rules and regulations, I can't do what I originally had hoped to do, but I bring in a bunch of apple cider, non-alcoholic apple cider, and we conduct toasts, and I surprise the students with this. So our very last act in my strategic communication class is we all stand up and we stand around in a circle. I give everybody a glass of non-alcoholic apple cider, and I ask them to toast to something that they are taking away of value from our class. It's a nice way to give closure to the class. It's a wonderful way for students whose minds are already beginning typically to transition to vacation or the coming term to really think about what they've worked on and how they've improved in class. But the cool thing is it's totally spontaneous. They don't know that they're going to do it, and they get up and they give these marvelous toasts. They're not very long, but they follow structure. They're engaging. They're compelling. And at the end of all of this, I just pose one question. I say, think back to when our term started and how you would have felt had I asked you to get up in front of all of us in this very public way and to share anything, let alone something that's personal to you. And you can see the light bulbs go off and the people really appreciating how far they've come. So to me, it's a nice way of closing out the course, but also emphasizing the progress people have made. After I ask that question, I give the advice, and I give this advice to all Toastmasters I come across, and I try to live by this myself, continually challenge yourself to develop your communication skills, hone those skills. We are only just starting on that process, and it's just a nice way to end, and it's a lot of fun too.
Of course, Matt, if they listen to this podcast or if they read the article in the August 2016 edition of the Toastmaster magazine, the cat will be out of the bag.
That's true. What a wonderful thing that would be.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to share with us once again here on the Toastmasters podcast. For those who are listening and would like to learn more about you or connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Let me give you two places to go. The first is a website I curate. It's around becoming a more confident and compelling speaker. It's called nofreakingspeaking.com, nofreakingspeaking.com. Or you can check out my consulting practice at boldecho.com, boldecho.com.
Matt Abrahams, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. That was fun. You guys are funny. Well, I totally appreciate your time, and I, you know, what you guys do is very important. So thank you for being willing to let me be part of it.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.